when I talk to families, I remind them that it's not the substance that defines the person. We found within our own family that focusing on the health and well-being and happiness rather than focusing on the substance, then we got the trust back within our family. And our daughter started talking to us again and telling us what she was struggling with. And I'll say to families that even if they regress, that's okay. They're going to fall once in a while and just be there to continue to love them and support them so they get back up and start going forward again.
Hello and welcome to Addiction Practice Pod, a podcast from the BC Centre on Substance Use about approaches to substance use care and treatment. This is a podcast for healthcare providers focused on issues in British Columbia. This season, we'll be spotlighting Indigenous perspectives on topics around substance use and addiction. And we'll focus on issues relevant for Indigenous people who use substances and discuss strengths-based approaches for all healthcare providers. And we're recording this on the unceded traditional territory of the Coast Salish peoples, including the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. The reach of this work touches on over 200 First Nations in BC. Hi, I'm David Ball, a journalist with a decade of reporting on substance use, mental health, public health policies, and Indigenous issues. In this series, we'll hear from Indigenous clinicians and people with lived experience on approaches to substance use care that work. Today, we'll be exploring how to understand and challenge stigma associated with alcohol use in Indigenous communities. And joining us as a clinical co-host today is Dr. Nolan Hopwoe, Medical Officer for Mental Health and Wellness at the First Nations Health Authority and a trained psychiatrist. He's also a member of the Métis Nation of Greater Victoria. Hi, Nolan. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, David.
Nolan, the focus of today's episode is on alcohol use and understanding and challenging the stigma that exists within some communities as well as within the healthcare system. Could you talk a bit about the contextual pieces? Like, what should we be thinking about when we have these conversations?
Sure. So understanding colonization and acknowledging how it can distort people's views towards Inuit, Métis, and First Nations is an important first step in dealing with harmful stereotypes. So we all, as healthcare providers, need to break down these stereotypes, and we need to be constantly challenging what we think about other people, and this can involve being open and curious about our assumptions. So I would like to point out two common misconceptions regarding Indigenous peoples and alcohol use. So the first incorrect assumption is that Indigenous people are more likely to drink alcohol, when in fact Indigenous people are actually less likely to drink than other Canadians. However, we do have higher rates of problematic drinking. And the second common misconception is that there's this long-standing idea that Indigenous people are more predisposed to alcohol use. And this is a myth that's been perpetuated in Canada for a very long time. However, I want to point out that there are no scientific information to suggest a genetic or a biological predisposition within Indigenous peoples towards alcohol use.
Well, that leads me into my next question, because those stereotypes are not just in society, but also within healthcare. In BC, the In Plain Sight report findings from 2020 outlined some of the impacts of stereotyping and stigma within healthcare settings. They found that 26% of Indigenous respondents reported always being treated as if they're intoxicated or being asked about substance use when accessing healthcare. That's compared to just 5% of non-Indigenous respondents. I'm wondering, what impact does this have on Indigenous people when it comes to them being able to access and receive care?
When it comes to accessing and receiving care, if we want to gain a clearer picture of how colonization which has been happening for hundreds of years and continues to happen today, and how that influences receiving care in BC, I'm glad you pointed out BC's In Plain Sight report. I can maybe just highlight it a bit more. It was produced in 2020 and updated a bit in 2021, and it specifically looks at discrimination and anti-Indigenous racism within our province here. I think it's also important to recognize that some of the other big findings from the report is that Indigenous-specific racism is widespread, and that's 84% of the Indigenous respondents experience discrimination within the healthcare setting. And so when asking about how does this impact Indigenous people when receiving care, So racism limits our access to services, and this is because people don't want to receive unsafe and discriminatory care. And I also want to highlight that Indigenous women and girls are disproportionately impacted.
Could you maybe speak a bit more about ways that systemic barriers and oppression have impacted Indigenous people in Canada and how that impacts things like high-risk alcohol use and access to care?
Sure. So colonization initially brought commercialized alcohol to Canada, and initially it was a way to trade for goods and services with Indigenous peoples. Alcohol later became part of the social norms within Canadian culture. Later, public attitude towards alcohol began to change, and it was later portrayed as being evil and undesirable. And this resulted in the introduction of nationwide prohibition during World War I, which lasted into the 1920s and beyond. And to further complicate things, the Indian Act, which is the legislation which was created in 1876 and created the legal rules for status First Nations people within Canada. The Indian Act did not allow for alcohol use until it was amended in 1985, with one of the reasons being to encourage First Nations people to give up their status in order to gain the same rights that all other Canadians had, which included alcohol consumption.
Well, in a moment, we'll be speaking with Beryl Park, a traditional wellness worker at First Nations Health Authority. What are you hoping to explore with Beryl today?
Yeah, I am very excited to learn and hear from Beryl about her experiences and insights in working with rural and remote First Nations communities.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be really interesting to kind of tease out how practitioners can actually consider some of these recommendations and what she has to say and maybe improving some of the care that's provided. So looking forward to that. So let's meet our guest today. Beryl Park is a social worker on the mental health and wellness team for the Vancouver Island team with the First Nations Health Authority. Beryl is from Haida Nation and belongs to the Sungul Stastis Eagle Clan. She's a mother of two children and works in the Kwakwaka'wakw territory on the lands of Wewakai people in Campbell River, BC. Hi, Beryl. Thanks so much for taking part in this podcast.
Thank you for asking me.
Well, I'm really happy to have you here and to have this conversation. Just to introduce myself before we start. I'm a journalist and have reported quite a lot on Indigenous issues, mental health, substance use. And my ancestry is actually from Ireland and Scotland, and my family settled in the Ottawa Valley and Algonquin territories. I'd also like to introduce our clinical co-host today, Dr. Nolan Hopwo. Hi, Nolan.
Hi, David. Tanchikiawau, Nolan Hopwo, Deshin Akashin, Anmitchif Nia. Thanks for having me. My name's Nolan Hopwo, and I am of Chinese Canadian ancestry on my father's side and Métis from my mother. And I'm broadcasting from the unceded and ancestral territories of Songhees and Esquimalt nations. And I also want to acknowledge that BC has a diverse makeup of Indigenous people. This includes over 200 First Nations communities, as well as First Nations people from other provinces and Inuit and Métis as well.
Beryl, could you introduce yourself to us and share maybe a little bit about the work you're doing?
My Haida name is Islaya. It means always doing something. And it was passed to me from my great aunt, Vesta Eden Shaw Hagman. My English name is Beryl, and I've been a social worker for over 30 years, and I've been with FNHA for just over 5 years. So the work I do is I cover all of the 15 communities for the Kwakwaka'wakw people, anywhere from Comox as far north as Kinkam Inlet. And in my role, it's basically to support communities with capacity development, visiting with them and identifying some of the concerns or what services they're asking for. It could be something from grief and loss, compassion fatigue for staff, self-care. One of our main, well, the main one right now is grief and loss and youth suicide prevention. And we also do work on elder abuse. And one of the other key ones we've done a lot of over the 5 years is lateral violence to kindness.
That's such important work you're doing. And I would say your Haida name is extremely well earned. Because we're talking about substance use and addiction in Indigenous communities, could you kind of give us a snapshot of the biggest and most urgent issues that you see?
with harm reduction. Well, right now, it's not the biggest issue with the opioid crisis and deaths from overdoses as a result of drugs with fentanyl mixed with it. But I still see alcohol as one of the worst things for our people. Basically, my role with harm reduction is when I go into communities, I talk about colonization and the timeline around all the impacts to our community and the trauma that we're all dealing with. Most of our people have anywhere from 5 to 6 specific traumas they're dealing with, where the average population for the settlers may be 2, 3, and 5 to 6 is low for a lot of our people. And then every time there's more losses within family groups, they're dealing with complex trauma. And then you'll see some that revert back to the coping skills they're used to using. And, you know, it could be just reaching for the substance to help numb the pain that they're dealing with.
It sounds like for a lot of these communities in crisis that the substance involved can change, but a lot of the mental health issues and trauma has a common factor between them.
Yes. And it's funny, I was talking to a lady yesterday and out in the Hattusat area in Zabalus, and we talked about how we both tried to stop the cycle of the use of substances, violence in the home, trying to protect our children from those things. But even though we didn't use substances, we tried to be the best parents possible. Both our children started using in their teen years, and you know, we're shaking our heads going, we were with them all the time. We were involved in sports, an integral part of their life. And yet peer pressure outside of the home or seeing other family members using the substances. And we both talked also about the new harm reduction model. And we've both had to support our own family members with detoxing. And I think it's really important to not just think about an abstinence model. You know, there's also other substances involved, and it's safer for their family member if they could try alternative methods.
Mm-hmm. So the focus of our conversation today is going to be about understanding and challenging stigma related to alcohol use, specifically within Indigenous communities. So in your opinion, why is it important that we have these conversations?
I think the language that we use specifically when we're talking to our loved ones and learning a new way of speaking with them so that they don't feel shame, they don't blame themselves, and just basically focusing on respect for the individual. And when I talk to families, I remind them that it's not the substance that defines the person. We found within our own family that focusing on the health and well-being and happiness rather than focusing on the substance, then we got the trust back within our family. And our daughter started talking to us again and telling us what she was struggling with. And even if she has, I'll say to families that even if they regress, that's okay. You know, it's like an infant learning how to crawl and walk. They're going to fall once in a while, and just be there to continue to love them and support them so they get back up and start going forward again.
I wondered if you could talk a bit about stigma you may have seen related to Indigenous people and alcohol use. Can you think of some examples for listeners who might want to know a bit more about that?
I used to go to the hospital here for a couple of the fellows that come in from their community, and then they're homeless around the Campbell River area. And often they would phone us right here at the office and let us know they were in town and one of them's in the hospital, and just making sure that the health providers know they have people that love and care about them. And we would go visit at the hospital and sit and talk with them. And it's just letting them know that you're there and letting others know, you know, that they're people that are loved by many. And quite often our presence changes the way they get treated in the hospitals.
It really sounds like a lot of the stigma is so closely related to racism and discrimination that Indigenous peoples experience. Could you maybe talk about how that would impact their experiences of community members facing that stigma or their access to healthcare?
Well, I'll speak from our family experience. And, you know, my daughter's a professional. And one, she had trouble accessing, wanting to go and access services close to where she works because one, she may run into clients that know her, or she may run into other professionals that know her. But with respect to racism, well, for this area, it's not good. Campbell River, Port Hardy, Port McNeil, people don't get treated well when they go and ask for support. They're often the last ones to be seen. Many of the individuals I know talk about arriving at the hospital wanting to get help, and they're waiting and waiting and waiting, and everyone else is being seen but them, and often sent home. We've had people in this area sent home and they've passed away. I know we're working on improving detox beds and trying to increase the services or have the intake process go much faster with getting into treatment programs, but it's trying to get them the support when they want it.
Yeah, you mentioned some of the ways that you've shown up for people, you know, to reduce the stigma that kind of shows that compassion for them. Could you talk about maybe some culturally safe and humble approaches like that as ways of reducing stigma around alcohol use that you'd like to see implemented?
Well, I'm happy to see that they're hiring more cultural supports within the health system and that our people have a familiar face. You know, our people, whether even though I'm parts, my family's part settler, other Indigenous peoples know when you have Indigenous heritage. They can tell by the way you talk sometimes, by your facial features, and just them having someone that really understands and is willing to listen to them and to help them navigate the systems. Because many people, even me, I'm 66, I'm still put off going to the doctor as much as I should, because I still have a little bit of distrust for the system as well, or thinking that I'm wasting their time. I'm not sick enough. There's more important people out there. But many of our people still don't like accessing the system. So if they have people in my role as liaison supports in the hospital, or individuals who are now, we have people in place that are ensuring that they're culturally safe. So if we get calls and we ask them if they would like support, we have individuals in the hospitals that can come and support you right away. So I think just if people come from the heart, our people can tell who's genuine. And if they feel that, then you're going to get better results for them.
I read in your bio that you would prefer to be called a traditional wellness worker as opposed to a social worker.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if you maybe told us a bit about why the importance of language and how maybe that's connected with stigma. That might help maybe illustrate some of the stigma that we're dealing with and how you're kind of changing that in order to make like a positive impact.
Sure. So that, as soon as you mention the word social worker, the first thing quite often I believe comes to mind for our people is the 60s scoop or the current scoop, the millennial scoop, and being taken away to the day schools or residential schools. As soon as they hear social worker, they're thinking child welfare more often than not. But if you say you're a traditional wellness worker, then they don't feel threatened. And they see someone who understands. I often share some of my similarities with them, or I understand what's happening with you. I can't always fully understand, but I get a good idea because I've lost loved ones they've used alcohol and died from, you know, liver disease. And I have many loved ones that are still struggling with substances. So when you come from that place, they don't get threatened. But if you're coming and saying, I'm a social worker, right away the wall goes up. And then you have to work at getting them to bring the wall down.
It's a great illustration of how, like, knowledge of colonization and its historical impacts and current impacts still affect Indigenous people, and how changes in language can help change perceptions.
Yes, I think so. And that's where, when I work with the harm reduction team, I work with a coworker who's always asking me to do workshops with her. And we talk about colonization and we talk about language, why language matters. Because we say one workshop isn't going to be enough on anything from grief and loss to self-care, lateral kindness especially. We've had 200 years of being taught a different way of living, and it's going to take us a lot more than one workshop to learn how to be kind to each other. Kindness is a huge part of harm reduction. We tried a tough love model approach with our son, and it didn't work. It was so hard to do, to try and push him away until he was asking for help. I had a friend from Squamish Nation, and she said, you know, Burl, we don't push our loved ones away. When they're struggling, we pull them closer and we hug them as hard as we can. And so I've learned over the years, tough love is not something that does work for our people. Hugging them close works better. With our daughter, we didn't want to be living in chaos anymore, and we had to find a way to work with our daughter and support her. For me, I think it was realizing that we were doing a lot of shaming and blaming for many years. And when we stopped doing that, the change was just sort of amazing that our daughter started to trust us. She trusted that if she talked to us, it was going to stay with us and we were going to support her as much as we could when we can, and we still do. She knows that I come from a probably still part of the intergenerational trauma. My grandmother wasn't very good at showing affection, but she always provided well for us with food, clothing, a warm house. Our mother wasn't very affectionate. I've had to teach myself to be more loving.
I wonder if you would speak to the continuum of alcohol use care and what that looks like in the context of rural and remote communities.
It's really hard sometimes. I see it on Haida Gwaii when I'm home because I have so many relatives that are still struggling mainly with alcohol, and they come home after doing programs away, and I've seen it with other remote communities. They have to have a really good plan when they're home. They're not just going to go to treatment, come home, and everything's okay. They still need to have some support with, whether it's informal counseling support, just having someone to debrief with and some place to go. Because quite often, I know on Haida Gwaii, they can do pretty good for 2 or 3 months, but they're gravitating towards the friends they had before they went to a program, and before long they're being offered substances. And I've seen a lot of the people go back because they haven't had that follow-up support. I like the idea that communities are coming up with having a 1 to 2 year program where they can go in detox, go in treatment, stay with their family in a facility or have housing for them, so the whole family can get the support. Because you're not just working with the one person. We all have to make changes. And we found that with our family as well. And to get away from the idea that when someone achieves sobriety or abstinence from other substances, I recall thinking, how long is it going to last with some of my loved ones in the past? And when our daughter achieved sobriety, my husband and I were talking about, we have to not go to that place of worrying all the time whether she's going to regress or, you know, relapse. and just continue to focus on her health and happiness and trust that every day she's making healthy decisions for herself and she's going to be okay. We know ourselves if there's a problem, but she reaches out to us now and talks to us more than she did before. And so I just think there still has to be a lot of really good supports. And often in remote areas, there's one community I work with right now that's very remote and there's very little in that community. And when they need it, they're either going to fly out or they have to go out on a boat. And the boat's very expensive to get in and out of that community. And it is difficult in some of those communities to have that sort of wraparound support.
I wonder if we could talk a bit about managed alcohol programs or MAPS. So MAPS is alcohol focused and it's not based on abstinence. It's kind of based on meeting people where they're at and creating a plan with a practitioner for allowing people to still consume alcohol, but at a certain kind of rate and under sometimes some type of supervision. So maybe you could tell us a bit about your experience with that.
I knew from the programs that were being trialed here on the island, especially during COVID. And sadly, I thought it was working really well in one of the communities, but one of them, again, there's that struggle with half of them wanting people to go back to abstinence and half of them wanting to have the managed alcohol program. We saw a lot of success on the north end of the island with the MAPS program. And I went to talk with one of the Coast Salish communities just about our own family experience with it, because they were looking at having the MAPS program as well. And I could see the divide at the table already. They did try it for a short period of time, but as soon as there was an election, one of the people that didn't like the idea canceled it in that community. So we could see how difficult it must be working in a detox center, because when we were doing it at home and we had to give a shot every 3 or 4 hours, and when our daughter wanted it much sooner, it was so hard not to give it to her at 2 hours. Or then if there was a bit of a clash, we would kind of talk about it. We'd try and talk with her about, you know, we're just doing what the doctor has told us and we don't follow that. But we would adjust it a little bit. Instead of 4 hours, if she came out at 3.5 hours, we would give it to her. So it's not an easy thing to do. I think that families can do it, though, but it's not going to go smoothly. But I know up on the north end of the island, during COVID especially, it saved lives.
It's a great illustration of like meeting people where they're at, as well as sometimes providing like wraparound supports from kind of local people who know the client.
Yeah, and I think that too is non-threatening. I remember when I was setting up a nonprofit society on Haida Gwaii back in the early 2000s, I had a small office and we had a kitchen area and a sitting area for individuals where they were considered homeless, but the definition for that up there was they were transient, because if one family member got tired of supporting them and moved them on. We had about 18 homeless at the time on the island, and I would tell them, I'm here to provide you with the support, and I'm never going to be pushing treatment onto you or counseling. I've got all that information here, but you're just welcome to come and have coffee. We had people come in to give foot massage, other massage. A nurse would come in once in a while just to be available to check on them if they needed it. And I would give haircuts a couple times a month, because I used to be a hairdresser in my former life. And so I'd give them their free haircuts. And while I was giving them haircuts, they were debriefing on their life story and telling me why they use substances. And I never ever pushed them, but over time, quite a few of them ask to see a counselor or to talk to someone about going into treatment. And I knew where all of our loved ones would go in the day. And if they didn't show up at the Healthy Community Society, I would go driving around. And if you know Amy Winehouse's song, I would crank that song up because I knew some of them were under a bridge area, and I would crank the song and they would come out from under the bridge and wave their fists at me because they knew it was me. And I'd say, hey, you guys haven't been up to the office. I've got soup on and there's coffee. And they would slowly work their way up there before the end of the day.
Some real lessons there, I think, that all of our listeners can take in terms of treating people with so much compassion as loved ones. Really wanted to thank you for your time today, Beryl, and a lot of these insights from both your professional work in so many communities and your own life.
Well, thanks for asking. And I've learned so much with FNHA, you know, on the language and meeting people where they're at.
Yeah, Beryl, thanks for taking the time to share your stories and talk with us about alcohol use and your knowledge. And thank you also for the work you're doing.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to meet you as well.
Yeah, you as well.
Such a pleasure. Take care. I feel like I learned so much from Beryl today. One thing that really struck me is that, you know, she acknowledged there is division in a lot of communities around issues around harm reduction and abstinence. And I feel like her personal stories and learnings really go a long way to helping bridge those divides.
Yeah, I mean, alcohol use disorder requires flexibility in approaches.
So we end every episode of this podcast by talking about a few clinical pearls of wisdom that we'd like our listeners to remember in their practices. Nolan, what are some that you take away from today's episode?
Take the time to explore what treatment and recovery look like from a patient's perspective. This can be facilitated by meeting people where they're at, being non-judgmental, and fostering a trusting relationship with patients. Secondly, to gain a more nuanced perspective into Indigenous peoples and our relationship with healthcare, you need to understand colonization and how it continues to impact Inuit, Métis, and First Nations peoples. Beryl highlighted the intersection of language and colonization during our discussion with her example of the term social worker and how this can elicit strong memories within Indigenous communities. The use of the title Indigenous Wellness Worker is strength-based while freeing itself of some of the associated colonial notions of healthcare and social services. Number three, consider managed alcohol programs, or MAPS, as an option for patients dealing with alcohol use disorder. MAPS can allow people to receive care in community and provide an opportunity for practitioners to build trusting relationships. MAPS also includes access to stable and measured amounts of alcohol, which reduce withdrawal symptoms, including the risk of alcohol withdrawal seizures.
Thanks so much for those, Nolan. It's been such a pleasure hosting today's episode with you.
Thanks for having me, David.
Thanks again to our guest today, Beryl Park. If you're interested in learning more about the contextual factors around alcohol use and Indigenous peoples, you can find some resources in our show notes. And help us create the best possible podcast by filling out our short survey. Just click the link to it in our show notes as well. This podcast comes from the BC Centre on Substance Use, with production from Cited Media. We are grateful for the time and expertise shared by Indigenous partners and collaborators related to producing this season. A special thank you to the Indigenous Initiatives team at BCCSU for their guidance and support. This program was made possible through the financial contributions from the BC Ministry of Health and BC Ministry of Mental Health and Addictions, with founding support from Doctors of BC and Health Canada. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of these organizations. I'm David Ball. See you next time.